This podcast is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more on demand at sevillepodcast.com. In this podcast, we join Jennifer Ackerman, Michael Sims, and Susan Frankel as they discuss natural history, science, and the interlocking life cycles of humans, other organisms, and the Earth itself. The discussion was a presentation of the Virginia Festival of the Book on Friday, March 28, 2008, in the City Council Chambers. Susan Tyler Hitchcock is the moderator.
So let me begin by introducing our three authors here, and then I'm going to let them take it away. Beginning on my right is Jennifer Ackerman, who is a Charlottesville author. Jennifer is a very renowned science writer. She's been writing about science for since 1989. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Natural History, among other magazines, as well as in anthologies, including the 2005 edition of Best American Science Writing. She has written three books, Notes from the Shore, which came out in 1995, Chance in the House of Fate, A Natural History of Heredity, which came out in 2001, and was awarded both the New York Times New and Noteworthy Paperback Award and also considered one of the best books of the year by Library Journal. The book she's going to be talking about with us today is her new book, Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream, A Day in the Life of Your Body. I also encourage you to get to know her website. Jennifer is the only person that I know, the only author I know, who has on her website a photograph of herself being interviewed by a chimpanzee. So Jennifer will speak with us. I also want to introduce Susan Frankel to my left. Susan began her work as a writer as a newspaper journalist working in Wichita and then in San Francisco, which is where she lives today. She's also contributed to the New York Times, Reader's Digest, and Smithsonian. And articles in both the Times and the Smithsonian led to the book she's going to be talking about with us today, American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. She describes this book on her website as the first book on an ecological catastrophe that profoundly reshaped the American landscape and the way we think about the natural world. And she's currently working on a new book about plastic going in the other direction under contract with Houghton Mifflin. Our third author is Michael Sims. Michael has contributed to a number of publications you know, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and some you might not know, including, I love this one, Creative Loafing. He has edited books as well, a collection of crime fiction and a new edition of Archie and Mehitable, the wonderful early 20th century poetry, I think we would say, written by a cat and a cockroach. And he's also written three books of his own, published three books of his own, Darwin's Orchestra, An Almanac of Nature in History and the Arts, Adam's Navel, A Natural and Cultural History of the Human Form, which came out in 2007, and this year, Apollo's Fire, A Day on Earth in Nature and Imagination. As one reviewer put it, Michael has the brain of a scientist and the voice of a poet. And he is working also on a new book, which is a natural history of four great children's books, Peter Rabbit, Wind in the Willows, Winnie the Pooh, and Charlotte's Web. These are fascinating people, fascinating books, and I'm going to let them take over from here. So each of them is going to introduce him or herself and their books, and then we will get the conversation going. So, Jennifer.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so happy to be on this panel with three terrific writers. Susan has a wonderful book about Frankenstein out, and she has an event coming up this evening. Hope you all can make it. Okay, so Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream is a book about what goes on in your body over the course of a 24-hour day. And it's kind of as you go through the motions of work and play, what's going on inside. And it begins with waking in the morning, sometimes a few minutes before your alarm clock rings. and then moves through the day looking at what we've learned lately about hunger, stress, fatigue, exercise, attraction, sex, sleep, dreaming, and also the daily rhythms that our bodies experience, which are known as circadian rhythms. So I thought I'd start this morning by offering you a little window on what may be going on in your body this morning, thanks to these circadian rhythms. Earlier this morning, say around 6 or 7 o'clock, your levels of the stress hormone, cortisol, and the sex hormone, testosterone, were peaking, along with the viscosity of your blood. And this, by the way, is a good reason to shave first thing in the morning, because your blood will clot more efficiently. Right now, your body temperature is rising from its low point, which was around 97 degrees Fahrenheit before dawn. So this means that if you took your temperature this morning and it was 98.6, that would actually indicate a low-grade fever, not a normal body temperature. And over the course of today, your temperature will rise 2 degrees, cresting in the early evening at 99 or even 100 degrees. This time of morning, your blood pressure and heart rate are peaking. So is your risk from stroke or heart attack. That's the bad news. The good news is that your ability to concentrate and to perform tasks involving short-term memory and logical reasoning may also be peaking. But maybe you're nonetheless a little distracted right now. Maybe you're only listening with half an ear while you read that book festival program in your lap, listing all the other events you might have attended instead of this one. If we were to scan your brain to look at its workings while you read, we might see, flashing brightly in the rear region of your brain, a highly skilled circuit of cells that allows you to recognize, in a mere 150 milliseconds, some 60,000 different words. And to tease out the subtle differences between, say, the words life cycle and bicycle. But this business of reading while you listen is straining your brain as it tries to toggle back and forth between two mental tasks. The fact is, our brains are really not built for this kind of two-timing. Our ability to multitask is a good deal less impressive than we might think. Witness the poor driving skills of folks blabbing on their cell phones. Their frontal cortex can handle only so many tasks at a time, so they slow down, they fail to change lanes appropriately, and they bunch up behind other slow-moving cars. And I was interested to learn that drivers who use cell phones add an additional 10% of time to the average commute. So I love this sort of hard evidence for what we know intuitively. And that leads me to my motivation for writing this book. I've been fascinated by the human body for years, and I've been squirreling away just this sort of news about its workings. And my interest in the subject was initially sparked by a particularly nasty case of the flu I had some time ago. And, you know, until then, I had really been a pretty unappreciative owner of my own body. Like most people, I really didn't have a handle on what was going on inside. You know, as one sage said, we often wonder at the mountains and the stars, but we pass by the miracle of our own inner lives without wondering. In fact, a lot of us spend our time trying not to be aware of what's going on within. No news is good news. So while I was recovering from this flu, it sort of hit me with a bang that I knew next to nothing about what was going on in my body, either in sickness or in health. And I didn't have the foggiest idea what a virus did to my body, or alcohol to my brain, or cumulative stress to my energy level. I knew I did some things more effectively in the morning and others in the evening, but I didn't have an inkling why. So my first thought was medical school, and I actually went so far as to enroll in a post-baccalaureate pre-medical program like the one that's offered here at UVA. But after some thought, I realized I did know one thing about my body, and that was that it needed sleep. And I really couldn't fathom how I was going to get through those 48-hour shifts demanded of medical residents. And besides, it would mean giving up writing, which was really my first love. So I began to approach the topic of the body from the outside as a writer. And I stashed away stories and studies and intriguing facts about the body that that captured my interest. For example, our bodies contain 10 times more microbial cells than human cells. That is, we're a kind of superorganism, 90% microbial, at least in terms of our cell count. We have these, we harbor within us tens of trillions of bacteria and yeast cells. And we don't look more like germs because of the small size of these cells relative to our own. Or this news, that thanks to the unique chemosensory system that we all possess, the flavor of our morning coffee is actually 75% smell. You take away coffee's aroma and the taste is merely bitter. Or this, that the chronic stress that many of us experience makes our bellies fatter and actually phrase our DNA. Or that a woman's facial features may reveal that she is ovulating. Or that lack of sleep suppresses our immune response and interferes with our ability to regulate our own blood sugar and our hormones. So in a nutshell, my files on these little facts grew fat. And a few years ago, I decided to plunge in and joyfully tackle the topics that have obsessed me for so long. I interviewed scientists and frequented their laboratories and conferences and subjected myself to some experiments to find out the latest understanding of sex, sleep, eating, drinking, dreaming, and a body's worth of other topics. So this book is the upshot of that happy labor. Okay, thank you.
Great. We'll hear more about it soon. Let me tell Susan to talk.
Okay.
Ask Susan to introduce herself and her book a little bit.
Okay. Well, my book is American Chestnut, and you know, had you told me 5 years ago I would have ended up writing a book about a tree, I would have said you were crazy. It was not really a natural topic for me. I'm not a gardener. You know, I like nature. I like the outdoors, but I couldn't tell you the trees that I pass. My husband is the one who keeps our house plants alive. But I do love good stories. And when I first heard about the American chestnut, I knew that I was on to a really good story. I came across it while I was working on a story for Discover magazine about a different tree disease called sudden oak death, which you may have heard of. It surfaced in Northern California in the late 1990s and started killing all of these oak trees and a related species called tan oaks. And for people in Northern California, it was just this catastrophe. The oak is one of the signal features of our landscape, and people were really frightened that we might lose it altogether. They didn't know where it had come from. And when I started interviewing the scientists who were working on it, I learned about the chestnut blight, which was sort of their point of reference for the past century, has been the point of reference for tree pathologists. And I had never heard of it before, but I quickly started reading about it and learned that up until the late 19th century, the chestnut was one of the most common trees in East Coast forests. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, it was a beautiful towering tree that pretty much dominated many of the forests, particularly in this part of the country, in the southern Appalachians. It had this incredibly versatile lumber that was used for everything from pianos to paper to packing crates, and it produced thousands of nuts every year that were devoured by pretty much every living creature within its ecosystem. It was particularly important to the people in the southern Appalachians who built their homes from chestnut logs. They brewed home remedies from chestnut leaves. They relied on the nuts that fell every fall to feed them, their livestock, and, of course, themselves. And then they used they sold the nuts to get the money to buy things that they couldn't buy for themselves, like school books or shoes. That blight was something that appeared in the late 19th century. It was brought in unwittingly on trees that had been imported from Japan and from China. And in its home habitat in Asia, the blight's fairly harmless. The trees there have kind of co-evolved ways to deal with it. But it was absolutely devastating to the American trees, American chestnuts, when they encountered it. And they had no real natural defenses to put up against this fungus. And pretty much most of them, when they encountered it, quickly sickened and died. Over the course of about 50 years, really in the space of a single generation, two generations maybe, the blight mowed down some 3 to 4 billion trees. And the species was really left pretty well decimated. That kind of widespread decimation in such a short period of time was what really hooked me into the story. I was amazed at the idea that something could change so quickly, but then I was also amazed by the way people reacted. And at the time, people treated the loss of the trees as if they were losing old friends, dear friends, which in a way they were. The trees were such a central part of the economy and culture of the southern Appalachians. And when you read about people's reactions at the time, there are just these poignant quotes. There's one man I quote in the book who said, "Man, I had the awfulest feeling looking around and seeing those trees a-dying. I thought my whole world was going to die." But even more poignant to me was the way that people continued to mourn the tree decades after it was gone. And for the book, I spent time in this one county in southwest Virginia, Patrick County. It's right by the North Carolina border. And was lucky enough to meet and talk with some older people who remembered the tree. And like one of them was this retired school teacher, Ruth Jean Bolt, who told me stories about the chestnut that had grown on her family's farm, and she remembered it as kind of this sentinel, was what she called it, that stood up from the landscape and always told her when she was nearing home. And she had this fuzzy black and white photo of this tree that was, you know, the kind of thing you find in family albums. That kind of nostalgia was one of the things that really got me sucked into the story. But the other thing that kept me there was this cast of characters I met in my research, the scientists who have just devoted themselves to this quixotic goal of trying to save this tree. There were people like this botanist in Connecticut named Arthur Harmont Graves, who spent decades trying to breed trees that could resist the blight, crossing Asian and American trees in every possible combination, never getting it, but you know, year after year, reporting with confidence that he was almost there. And he was, you know, even into his 80s, he was still out in his orchards pruning trees and tending to them and, you know, horrifying his wife. or one of the first people I met and a person that I profiled in a story and said to myself, if I'm still interested in it at the end of this story, I'll do a book, was this biologist at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, a guy named Hill Craddock, who is just this delightful person, and he believes the world is a better place with chestnuts, and he has believed this for a long time. He used to make up chestnut soup and serve it to non-believers because he said, after you eat that, you'll be hooked on chestnuts. When he was a student in college, he used to harvest chestnuts. This was in Bloomington, Indiana. He would harvest chestnuts, plant them, grow out these little tiny chestnut trees, and then go around and give them to homeless people that he encountered because he thought, well, this way they'll have a source of food forever. He's just a great guy. Or Phil Rutter, who founded the American Chestnut Foundation, who is this truly eccentric character. He lives in central Minnesota in this one-room log cabin that he built. He's got no running water, no electricity. He lives in an Amish community, and his neighbors consider him sort of honorary Amish. But he also has 5 computers to plot out his breeding program and a solar generator for his greenhouse and, you know, a high-tech composting toilet. And, you know, and Phil is this person who knows more about chestnuts than you will ever want to know and has this absolute and utter conviction that humans were the people, we were the ones who brought chestnut, laid chestnut low, and we have an absolute obligation to restore it. And in the course of meeting these people and in writing the book, I realized that my own focus had changed. I started the book with this question of what happens to a landscape when a central feature of it disappears, and I thought that that's what the book was going to be about. And by the end of the book, and it really literally took me 2 years to figure out this rather obvious point, was that what I was really writing about was this relationship between people and another species, and this love affair between people and this tree with sort of a one-way love affair, admittedly, but you know, it was really about this affinity, and that affinity was what kept the efforts to restore the chestnut going. And I, in the end, kind of realized that it was this kind of affinity that really lies at the heart of conservation efforts and people's drive to do something about improving the environment, and recognizing that our fate on this planet is linked to all those other little critters and plants and flora and fauna that surround us, which was, you know, an interesting point to get to, and kind of a surprise to me. But that ended up being the real subject of the book. So I guess that's where I'll stop.
I meant to mention, by the way, that right after this, there is another panel that Susan's on called
Old Chestnuts, Culture and Conflict.
She'll be talking more about the actual content of the book. Michael.
Okay. I've been listening to both of the other writers here and thinking about that wonderful old term, natural history. It's the title of the panel is Life Cycles, Science Writing, but they keep bringing up the very important, crucial point that science is a human endeavor. It's not just unraveling how the world works. It's unraveling our relationship with it. And very often, it starts with people passionate and fanatical about chestnuts, or somebody who has a terrible case of the flu and thinks, how does this work? And I've read, I've been reading Jenny since her very first book. So I can highly recommend her as one of these people who brings together the human and passionate side of it. I just started reading Susan's book, and it's the same combination of human and natural. And so I kept hearing this term natural history, and I thought that really this is what interests me more than just there are some kinds of science writing. There are plenty of science books out there, especially on physics a lot of times, where no human beings seem to show up, actually, in the course of the book. And you have the fascinating voice-over of a brilliant brain, frequently very charming writer or whatever, but it all takes place in a galaxy far, far away. And so this human element is part of what interests me. And in the introduction to this book, Apollo's Fire, which is about the course of a day from dawn until into the nighttime, I quote in the introduction a wonderful line from Thoreau, who said that he used to keep two notebooks, one for facts and one for poetry, until he kept realizing his most interesting observations in life, he couldn't figure out which notebook they should go into. And one of the things I say in the book that has been quoted in several reviews is, what could be more poetic than the bare facts of the cosmos? And so this grew out of the same sort of thing and of the personal interaction with the world, because what I find so fascinating about both Jennifer Ackerman and myself being on the same panel is, before Apollo's Fire, I wrote a book called Adam's Navel, A Natural and Cultural History of the Human Form. And it was the visible body. It was as much the cultural movies, poetry, everything, how we've responded to it, as why it is the way it is. But it was the visible, external body that you can see when you reach for the bottle and drive and look in the mirror and shave and across the breakfast table at your spouse. And someone said, why don't you write a book on the inside of the body? And reading Jennifer's book reminded me, I am not brave enough to go there. I have a friend in Nashville who describes many of the things that science describes as, to use a very technical term, icky. And so some of the things I've learned in reading Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream are reminding me how incredibly terrifying it is in the dark, desperate inner cavern of the body, and that even the craziness on the outside seems calm by comparison. But another thing that interests me about this idea of life cycles is the history behind it, that the evolution of the bacteria in the body, that we carry this vast ecosystem of body, like we're just, I mean, of microorganisms, as if we're a fancy monkey bus driver or something. I mean, millions of years of our own evolution, we're largely carrying around other creatures. And then the life cycle of the chestnut is the same sort of thing to me, because you realize that with the evolution of it on the other side of the world, its trouble started when it was moved away from where it had grown up and co-evolved with so many other creatures and plants. So I was thinking about that with the experience of the course of the day in Apollo's fire. It is what you see when you wake up. It's the color of, it's why the light is so golden coming in the window and sneaking through the many blinds as you wake up. It's the gradual warming of the day, the changing of the light, it's sunrise colors, sunset colors. Then shadows, pausing to think a little bit about shadows and how incredibly strange they are and how crucial they are to art and how many revolutions in art from the Renaissance to the Impressionists have been in looking anew at shadows and how they anchor us in a scene. And so then moving through to the rise of air pollution in the course of the day, ozone climbing. So then I thought it was a good time to look at the difference in, since we're following the track of the sun all day, to look at the difference in ozone in the upper atmosphere protecting the Earth and the kind of ozone accumulating in the afternoon as heat and air pollution combine. Then it's twilight, and each of the moments of the day, I wanted to look at what's really happening that happens so frequently that we don't even notice it. And it's that wonderful old line that to see anything for the first time, you have to see it again and again. And so I thought, well, what is more invisible to us than our experience of the day? And if you look back in the history of art and archaeology, earliest moments, the rising sun is one of the first things ever recorded, even in rock art. And the whole idea that our first sense of narrative may have come from this reliable cycle. Because long before we understood about moon, understood about months, or even made the connection between sexual intercourse and childbirth, which after all do occur some distance apart, before we got all of those rhythms figured out, and before the Arabs figured out so long ago cycles of eclipses and everything else, we were watching the day and making up reasons for it happening this way. And what I keep coming back to in nature writing and science writing is that the human imagination never waits until the facts are in. So there we are, and I don't mean to repeat that idea that 10,000 years ago we were children as a species and that we've gradually grown up to our remarkable maturity now. But I do think there's clear evidence that this, our perception of all of this has evolved in a beautiful relationship between ourselves and the world. And there's a beautiful line that I quote in one of my other books, in Adam's Navel, which is Guy Davenport, who you may be familiar with, fabulous essayist, brilliant man, who died not very long ago. He had this wonderful line, is the dividing line between nature and culture the human imagination? And so I keep coming back to that wonderful idea that after millions of years, billions of years of the evolution of the Earth, the physical changes on the Earth, the slow growth of life, you get this moment of imagination, of something leaping between here to here. And you can see it in chimpanzees. They perform jokes. They know how to plan going into a room and unlocking a box and taking things out. That's a leap of imagination. And so what interests me the most, I think, is that we are nature contemplating itself. We are the elements looking in the mirror. And that fascinates me. And so I wanted to slow down the process of an ordinary day and track it through our experience. And so in a sense, what Jenny is doing on the inside of the body with her new book, I'm doing everything that happens outside the body. So I just found this a beautiful parallel to be on a panel with this kind of long-term life cycle, immediate life cycle, and the one we ignore every day. So I think I'm going to stop right there. Thank you.
Well, there are lots of ideas bouncing around here and lots of things, points of connection. Let me just begin by asking a question, and then I'm going to invite questions from the audience as well. But I'd like to begin by asking all of you to tell us a little bit about how you found the narrative line. I mean, a book is, to a large extent, especially a book that's entirely text, a linear experience. There's a beginning, there's an end, there's a pathway. And yet what you're writing about are abstract ideas, they're people, characters, they're the sun and the moon, pretty amazing concepts. How do you find a storyline in all of that?
Yeah, I think it's the biggest challenge of the kind of writing that Michael and Susan and I do is finding that narrative thread. And I love what you said, Michael, among other things, but about that our first sense of narrative being that reliable cycle that we're all a part of every day. I really struggled with how to make a story out of all this material that I had. And, you know, there's some obvious ways of approaching the human body. You can do it by system. You can do it by, you know, organizing it around topics. You can do it by the big life cycle of birth to death. You know, what I realized is that what that would probably create is a series of essays. And I love essays, but in publishing, the word is considered a dirty word. Essays don't sell as well as a storyline. And there's you know, probably a good reason for that. Much as I really do love the essay form, I think people are automatically drawn to a storyline, especially when you're dealing with maybe some difficult science material. You want to make it accessible to people, and the story is a really good way of doing that. So it was really only after I learned about the really powerful influence of circadian rhythms on our bodies that I thought, oh yeah, the 24-hour day, that's a natural narrative right there. It's a unit of our lives, really. And there was some really neat material about the circadian peaks and troughs of various functions in our body that I realized I could actually use as a way of discussing those topics at the appropriate time of day. You know, for instance, the time of day when your body is best at physical exercise. Well, okay, that's in the late afternoon, and I would put that narrative there. So it took me a long time to get to this very obvious point, but there it is, and you know, it's. Like Michael, I was sort of struck by, I think of his book as really an erstwhile twin of mine, and the fact that we were writing these books at the same time, unbeknownst to each other, is great, and the fact that we came up with the same narrative structure.
Other ideas on this?
Well, you know, for me, there was a built-in story arc, which was the chronology of the tree. You know, its existence pre-blight, post-blight. The big challenge for me was how to create a storyline with a tree as a central character, which was really drilled into my head after I sent out my story proposal, my book proposal, and all these publishers were like, 300 pages about a tree? We don't think so. So what people wanted were people engaged with the tree. And so, you know, that I finally, this was my first book, so it was a big, huge learning curve. I was lucky enough to find that there was very good documentation in the way of oral histories, these wonderful oral histories recounting how people felt about the tree before the blight and then during the blight, you know, both literally oral histories, Foxfire. I don't know if you're familiar with that publication, but Foxfire had done a series of interviews that I drew on quite heavily. And then I was really lucky because I found out that this historian named Ralph Lutz had done the documentation to sort of back up all of the anecdotal evidence about the importance of the tree. And his article on this came out just about the time that I was starting my research, and so, you know, that saved me years of work, because Ralph had gone around these six counties in Southwest Virginia and painstakingly gone through all of these the old receipt books of county stores and railroad receipts, and shown how important the nut trade, the chestnut trade, was to people there. And so I went down then to Southern Virginia and put an ad in the paper and got hold of a 92-year-old guy who remembered this, just this lovely man, Early McAlexander. And then he introduced me to other friends of his who also remembered it. And, you know, I think a lot of, I don't know, for some research, some people may be more systematic in their research. I rely a lot on serendipity, and it seems to be working. And so, I got to them, and then I was lucky on the other side of the blight to find that there were just these wonderful scientists who all had really engaging personal stories. And because I think passion is interesting to look at, and it's fun to read about, and they were all just fantastic characters who had great ability both to explain their science and to put it into terms that were I could make clear to people, but also had good individual stories about why they loved the tree and why they loved this research. So that all allowed me to kind of introduce a human element that made this more than just a story about a tree and brought the tree to life.
Well, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is the difference in this story. In the approach to the narrative is, for example, Jenny's book does cover 24 hours, and mine doesn't. It starts when you wake up, and it ends when you go to sleep. So that was part of the narrative structure for me, was what are we experiencing? It's a very visual book, and a good bit of sound in it, too, of what the day sounds like in the course of the day. But especially visual. It's an appreciation and sort of lyrical attention to these various phenomena in the course of the day. So one of the questions for me was how to put the narrative together. I first wanted to write about everyday life. Well, you know those, you're in junior high and you tell the teacher you're going to write an essay called Life. In the first place, it's a little hard to outline. And also, you know, you're in junior high and what do you really know? Well, you discover in science writing, whatever age you are, you're bound to think, what do I really know? So I had to think about all of these many issues that interested me. And part of the connection for me was also characters, because I don't go interviewing scientists in this. I did some behind the scenes, but the book is told largely in second person, as in, as you wake up, the light coming through the window sort of approach. But there were characters that I thought were really interesting, and I had to find the parts of day where their stories would fit best. And I managed to work in Rod Serling trying to figure out a name for his show for The Twilight Zone. Because really, if we're talking about the symbolism as much as the natural experience of the day, why not the noon zone? Well, because the bright light of noon vanquishes the most resilient spook. What about the midnight zone? No, that's the witching hour. Something bad's definitely going to happen. So twilight, well then the whole history of twilight is uncertainty, that anything could happen. Why? Well, then it's our whole natural history. It's our whole changing visual perception and what that's triggering in the brain, which even is triggering a measure of anxiety because of the uncertainty of darkness before industrialization. So there's so many, many things tied into all of this. So I wanted to work in Charles Darwin's wonderful, I keep coming back to him, I've written a good deal about him over the years. He's a fascinating and very funny man, and also one of the most adoring husbands and fathers in history. And a doting, I have a weakness for people who dote on their children. And so Darwin has this wonderful experience of studying the movement of plants. It was one of his most renowned later books that isn't remembered as much as the scandalous ones. But he worked with one of his sons studying plant movement, the circadian rhythms of the world outside us. And they're funny and they're fascinating moments of first beginning to realize, because he really, at one time, he just suddenly asks himself, it's not sudden, but an accumulation of different details, and he asks himself, he sort of turns to his son and says, Bernard, do plants sleep? Well, your father's Charles Darwin, you're a little inhibited. You're going, I don't know. And so I wanted to get in a little bit to his personality and his very easygoing, modest approach to the world, and that he was so obsessive in experimenting around the house. I wanted all this to go into the book. That for the first eight years, he worked on studying barnacles, Cirripedia. And he 8 years to produce these two vast volumes about barnacles. Well, his younger child had never seen him do anything except dissect barnacles. He hadn't thought about that. And so one day, and it's taken him 8 years, one day his 7-year-old daughter is visiting John Lubbock's family next door. And she's looking around and she goes, "Where does your dad do his barnacles?" And so that made me think, okay, so there's not only the human side of the passionate interest, but there's the way the ripples move out from that. So I kept thinking about how does each of this fit into the story, and I went around and around, as they did. And the idea of a natural history of everyday life, I kept pinning down and trimming this and this and thinking, well, I can put that in a later book. I can do a book on weather later. I'll put that over there. And so then I was thinking, well, then Darwin's plant experiments about light change would be a beautiful way to go into Twilight. Then Galileo, the most wonderful, fascinating thing about him to me is that he is that moment when he's taking the telescope, which is a brand new toy, and looking at the moon, and he's seeing the shadows change, and he's the first person in history to be standing there doing this. And he literally tells this in The Starry Messenger, which is a wonderfully well-written, very smart, and somewhat witty book. And he tells this story that he was looking at it, and the lights were changing on the face of the moon. And he remembered being on a mountaintop in Italy looking down at the valley as the sun came up. And he thought, my God, can I be watching sunrise on the moon? It changed the history of the whole human race at that moment. And so I thought, these are moments of realization that turn this into a human story and the history part that I was talking about both of them. But I needed to frame it in terms of what each one of us experiences on an ordinary day. That's a long-winded answer.
That's a fascinating answer. We'd love to hear questions from the audience. If you have a question, would you raise your hand and let this young woman here bring you the microphone so it's part of our recording.
I was wondering how long it's taken you to write these books, and do you do other things in between, other articles, or are you just sort of concentrating on this?
The life of the writer.
Well, it usually takes me 4 to 6 years to write a book. I wish I was a little bit faster, but I'm not. And one of the reasons is that I have children I dote on, Michael. And also, I do magazine articles. I like alternating between the short form and the long form. Books are, it's just a long process, and sometimes it's a very lonely process, you know, especially once you've done all your interviewing, you've been out in the world, and then you have to come back and just sort it all out, and it's you and the page. And so it's fun to be able to take on shorter pieces that have a little bit, more quick satisfaction. So I do go back and forth.
This took me between 2 and 3 years. And I also, I'm not very good at switching focus. Like when I'm on a topic, that's what I'm thinking about, and that's what I want to be thinking about. And in fact, it was very sad when I finished the book, and I was in the shower one day, and I realized I'm not thinking about chestnuts anymore. But I also am a very slow writer,
Faster than I am.
Well, this was a more contained. I'm looking ahead at the next one, and it's a little terrifying. And have children, so it's a slow process. And I always have to plug I'm in a writing group, which I can't imagine doing this completely alone. I'm in a group with 9 other women, and we meet twice a month and share our work, which makes that lonely process so much better, because it really is. Otherwise, it's just you sitting there trying to figure out this really hard stuff. So,
I have to agree about the part about disappearing for a long time into one project. Sometimes you come back, you go away and you write a book, and you come back and you're waving this stack of wrinkled manuscript, and you're going, I've been in the desert, I had a revelation, I'm back. And the publishing world is going, were you gone? And so, I mean, it's under contract, you have your money up front, but still, you're going off in your own little world, and My wife and I joke that I'm, oh no, I've signed a book contract. I'll be going off in my own little head. Call me if you need me. And so I definitely alternate articles too. I love to review books. So that's one of the smaller things I do. It keeps me paying very close attention to other people's writing, which I find enormously helpful. And then I just do all kinds of articles around the edges, some related, a lot of them related to nature and culture. And then this book took a pretty long time. It's probably took longer than any of my other books, and it's a shorter book than any of the others. This ratio terrifies me. I did the math. When I'm 68, I'll spend the next 12 years writing a limerick. And then I'll die, and, you know, and my publisher will go, oh, well, you're gone. And so this was maybe even 2.5 years in there, but I did get married and honeymoon. Oh, I'm making excuses. And move across country. Anyway,
why is it then that your most recent book before this is a 2007 book and this is a 2008? Looks like you're cranking them out to me.
It takes a long time.
Well, the last two or I edit collections for Penguin. I mean, I'm not employed by Penguin, but I keep coming up with ideas they like. And I did some. I heard someone say, "Oh, when Susan said Archie and Mehitabel." Yes. Okay, so it's lovely to find fans of those. That's incredibly brilliant, insightful humor classics from the early years of the 20th century. And there were three volumes of those, and so I put those, I presumed, to in the hopes of rebuilding the gentleman's reputation, Don Marquis, to do an annotated version in which I took all the poems and put them back in their chronological order, looked at the newspapers and reconstructed all that. So part of what I'm doing around the edges is other kinds of books. And I just finished this past week a collection of Edwardian crime classics for Penguin, the kind that a corner that no one's ever visited before, which is con man stories and caper stories from that era. So I do sort of an anthology or something like that is in between articles and a book. It's not my writing, but it requires a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Another question.
Yes. Welcome to Virginia. I hear people that move here from other places, and they talk about the natural beauty here. And as someone who's in love with the American chestnut, I see a scab instead of the natural beauty that they talk about. I have hepatitis C, so I understand viral infestations. And I know that hepatitis C will not decimate the human population here, but the chestnut was more subject to like a shock and awe, that clear day thunder that they talked of. And I'm afraid that now, because so many of the plants, and I don't know about the animals, but so many of the plants in the Appalachians have relatives in the East, and I mean the Far East, maybe even closer related than to the plants on the West Coast, and which is really weird, but that's the way it happened. And I'm wondering if through importations, if we haven't learned anything, and we're going to bring in something else like the tree from hell, the ailanthus or something, and
kudzu,
any of these things, kudzu, they're just out of control.
Well, I mean, it's a huge problem, and that's one of the things that really stood out to me in looking at the American chestnut story. You know, the American chestnut prompted the passage of the Plant Quarantine Act, which was sort of the first federal legislation to deal with the problem of invasive species. That was in 1912, so we're almost 100 years later, and we are still bringing in invasive species every day. The USDA inspectors are only able to inspect about 1% of all the importations that come in. And in fact, sudden oak death, the disease that got me started on this, that was a disease that was brought in on ornamentals from Asia and from Europe, surfaced in Northern California. There were sort of a series of quarantines radiating up the West Coast to try to prevent it from spreading. Meanwhile, a plant nursery in LA, which is one of the biggest plant nurseries in the country, ships all over the country, sent azaleas to the East Coast that were infected. And this was in, in the early 2000s. And so, you know, there's actually a real danger of the sudden oak death pathogen, which is a very virulent pathogen with dozens of hosts, getting out into the wild on the East Coast. It infects some of the species of oak trees that are really important commercial species. It is an ongoing problem, and we haven't really figured out how to deal with it or what to do about it. I know the Forest Service at one point was sending people both sending people back to countries like China to try to look at how various pathogens might behave in China, and also people have talked about planting American plants in botanical gardens in other parts of the country to see what will happen, you know, if you put a dogwood in Europe or something. But I think it's a really tough issue, and I think we don't devote nearly enough money to dealing with it, and we're a global economy, so it continues to be a problem. I think you're right to be concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The chestnuts. I recall reading about 10 years ago or so that a stand of immune trees had been found in Westchester County, New York. Are you aware of that, or are there trees that are immune to the blight more generally?
You know, there are. One of the unfortunate things that happened is when the blight hit, the Forest Service basically took the attitude, any chestnut is a goner, so chop them down. And it made it difficult to discern whether there were trees that actually carried any residual resistance. I think most scientists now would say, yes, there are some trees. I don't know about the Westchester trees, but it's estimated there are probably, I don't know, 400 to 500 mature chestnuts along the range that are still out there, still living. The Amherst County tree is one in Amherst County, Virginia. Its location is a well-guarded secret. I wasn't allowed to publish it because they were very nervous that people would come and steal from it. There are probably chestnuts that have some resistance to the blight and are able to, for various reasons, endure. There's a grove in Wisconsin that I went to that was started at 6,000 trees. It was started from 8 nuts planted by a farmer in 1900. Now it's about 6,000 trees, and it was blight-free for a long time. And then in the early 80s, the blight got there probably, you know, it's like an infection that was probably lit by a single spore. And the trees are now dying. But the scientist who took me there saw that on some of the trees, there's evidence that they seem to be fighting back. And he actually thinks that there may be some trees in that grove that have some resistance.
Another question.
Yes, I do. All of you have made science accessible, and I'm really grateful for that. And I wish that one of you or all of you would look at another question that's about to be done in the Chesapeake Bay, and that's the introduction of the Asian oyster to replace the Chesapeake Bay oyster. It scares me so very much, and I wish that one of you, you know, the scientists are studying it, the watermen are pushing for it. You know, they keep bragging about how big this oyster is going to grow, and I'm thinking, and it doesn't, you know, it goes flat. It doesn't build a reef. It goes flat. And I think, oh, please, one of you, please take on that subject and work on that before it's too late. They just passed another permit to allow it to be in a controlled environment. All it's going to take is one that's not sterile before it'll. I really worry about that.
Why
really
are they putting
hoping,
it in there? Why are they putting it in there?
Because they want to save the watermen. They want to try to clean the bay again. But I just, how many horror stories do we need? And I wish one of you would embrace that and please.
Could I take that question and go a little broader, which is to ask each of you whether you feel you have a mission in your science writing?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, you know, it's, I'm really compelled by what the story that you're describing. Actually, in my first book, Notes from the Shore, I have a chapter called Strange and Wonderful, which is about introduced species and the completely unanticipated and devastating impact that these seemingly innocuous introductions have. And, you know, we really have such hubris in this that we think we understand how an ecosystem will respond to the introduction of a species, and really we're clueless. The interactions are so complex and so delicate that the repercussions really are just unknowable, and can be terrible. The issue is that, you know, there are a lot of these stories out there, and there are some great people writing about the problem of invasive species. And I think, you know, this one sounds like a great short piece for a magazine, to just bring people some awareness of the issue.
Yeah. You mentioned a term that's one of the fictions under which government so often operates, which is controlled environment. and that, I think, as they've both written about a great deal, and I have some, there is no such thing. It's a ridiculous human concept to begin with. The whole idea of any part of nature could be other than porous and other than interacting and co-evolving. The question of the mission is a scary one, because it's almost scary for the writer in the sense of, I think with any kind of writing or any kind of educational aspect or artistic, there's the question of to what extent do you have a commitment to go as far as you can. If you're a novelist, you should, you know, are you digging as deeply as you can? And as a science and nature writing, how much are you grappling with the issues? I thought about that in this book because it's an ecologically minded, but it's not investigative or cutting edge in that way. And I talk some about pollution in the course of the day because it's changed our experience of the day, of course. But that was an issue for me is how much commitment to dealing with very urgent issues. And most of the time, I think my science writing and nature writing are more looking into the history and cultural response. So I go around feeling a little guilty sitting beside people who are doing rather more urgent topics than that, because I'm tending more for the long view, I think. So I'm confessing guilt here.
I am sort of guilty too. I'm a very curious person, and I tend to write in response to my curiosity. And so it's kind of a selfish process. That said, I realize when I look back through my writing, there's sort of a constant theme, which is what Jennifer mentioned, this idea of hubris. I mean, we are a very hubristic, I don't know how you would pronounce it. We have a lot of hubris. We presume a lot. We presume we understand a lot. And at the same time, we also presume that our actions somehow will have very little impact, and we don't really recognize or acknowledge our own footprint. And so I've sort of stumbled into, I wouldn't say it's a sense of mission. I'm not a particularly proselytizing writer, and I don't like to read that kind of work. But I think it ends up having that kind of impact. It's a challenge. The next book I'm working on is this book about plastic, where, you know, people have, I thought people had strong feelings about the chestnut. People have really strong feelings about plastic, and it's some of it's kind of counterintuitive. And I'm really having to sort of juggle how much I want that to be a book that is investigative or tells people, you know, you need to think about it this way, and how much it's just, I find there's a lot of interesting, quirky and things that I didn't know and that I probably other people didn't know about it.
You know, I think if there's a common mission among the three of us, it's really about, you know, our writing all is directed inspiring people to care about the natural world. And my feeling has always been that it's better to do that through the back door. In other words, don't hit them over the head with, you know, the sky is falling, because there's a kind of exhaustion that sets in when you read that kind of hard-driving environmental reporting. I think in some ways it's more effective to slide in, the kind of writing that that Michael does, which is this marriage of poetry and natural facts, just makes you care about the subject. And Susan's as well, listening to the stories of the people who are so passionate about this tree and its history, that brings people around, in some ways, more effectively than the more hard-driving reportorial approach.
There's someone in a panel I was listening to once said they're trying to get from Gee Whiz to be careful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, yes, that's exactly. Right. But starting with Gee Whiz often works better. Because then they don't have time when you say be careful to say why or who cares. Right. You've sneaked up on them.
Right.
Yeah. Jennifer, in writing or doing the research on your book, do you have any observations about the way medicine is practiced and the advice we get about our general well-being and so forth? Any thing that you picked up?
I have a couple of thoughts that come to mind. First of all, we need to let our doctors sleep. Very interesting to me that it's taken us so long. The studies are now coming out looking at the effect of sleep deprivation in the practice of medicine and the incidence of errors. And we have this sort of macho approach to doctoring, and I think that that really needs to change. But in terms of the practice of medicine and I think the pace of information that we're getting now from research in medicine is really relentless, and we're we're in a phase now where we're trying to absorb it. And one of the interesting things that I ran across researching this book was the whole concept of circadian rhythms in medicine, and there's very new research that really suggests that the body responds to medications that our circadian rhythms affect our response to medications. So in something like chemotherapy, you can actually increase the effectiveness of a chemotherapeutic agent and reduce its toxicity by timing the medication, the delivery of medication. Now, this is still a very new idea, and not that many doctors are aware of it or putting it into practice. So that's an area that that I think is just beginning, and really has could have some very profound implications for the way we practice medicine.
May I just add to that part of the issue there is what we were talking about in these other things, that medicine treated the human body as a controlled environment, mm-hmm. With no input, nothing going out, nothing coming in, just right. This robot.
And as if something as innate and utterly natural as sleep, we can, push the boundaries. We don't need, we live in a culture in which sleep is completely denigrated and devalued, and the less sleep you get, the tougher you are.
Yeah. And what are we doing with this? Watching TV? Come on.
Yeah, right.
I think you've come to the perfect place to talk about the chestnut, obviously. I have chestnuts growing on my property, and I'm wondering if you think that that some of the love that people have for this tree and the way they hold on to it is the fact that it has held on. My chestnuts grow back, and I'm always thinking, oh, maybe this one will get bigger than 3.5 feet before it. But the roots of the original tree are still there, still trying. So I'm wondering if you think that has any effect on the real affection in this area for this tree.
Well, what you're saying is a perfect, testimony to that. Yeah, I think it does. I think it's, the tree's own tenacity is pretty inspiring, its own clear, desire to live and to keep going. I mean, without trying to, personify it. I do think that that's true. And I think the continued existence of those stumps, one of the guys that I interviewed, the scientist, that's what got him into it in the first place, was he said he used to go hiking in the Shenandoah Valley and kept coming across these huge stumps. And there is just something that pulls on you when you see, oh my gosh, there were once these enormous, wonderful beings that aren't there anymore, if you're attentive to it. Yeah.
I wonder if any of the three of you have anything in mind that you haven't said or that you'd want to ask each other.
I have a question for Michael, which is that, you talked about how you started the book. I mean, did you have this well of information that was rattling around in your head and you thought, okay, I'll stick Darwin here? Or are you just reading and reading and reading? And how did you go about it? Because it is so rich and dense.
Good heavens. A lifetime of very disorganized, curiosity-driven reading, and wide-ranging but utterly unsystematic. And so I would, some of these things I'd always wanted, I knew about Darwin's experiments with circadian rhythms, and of course Galileo looking at the moon and things like that, so those occurred to me. but I had to go back and research all the details and a lot of things, such as I had vague notions about how carbon monoxide and ozone built up in the afternoon and things like that, but it took some digging and talking to various people. I love the implication that I might have just had all this on tap. But really, what I have are all these little bells going off, and then I go, oh, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm saying, I take a notebook out of my pocket and say, write down dirt and blue and Kowalski, or whatever, to my wife, and she'll go, blue, dirt, Kowalski. Because I'll go, I've got this great idea, and then you go looking into it, and I'm sure all four of us have had this experience plenty of times. You get there, excuse me, you have this wonderful bell going off, and you get there, and you go, oh yeah, that wasn't about dirt at all. That was something else, and you can't use it. So there's a great deal of avenues you explore and only use 2% of. And you talked about that a little bit with Frankenstein. Her most recent book, Susan Tyler Hitchcock, our moderator, her most recent book is A Cultural History of Frankenstein, which she's talking about tonight at 6 o'clock, I'm going to mention, because she won't. But it's part of all the avenues you explore in the course of finding your story. Mm-hmm. And, you didn't have everything in the world about Frankenstein on tap to begin with, did you? If so, I can hear you.
No, and it was the same, not at all. And it was the same kind of thing. There's an idea, you pursue it, you research it, you find the larger context and more information about it, and then maybe it fits or maybe it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And you weave it in as it does.
And you save the parts that don't fit because you have other books in mind. Or someone may call you and say, do an article along the edges of your new book. Right. And so you go, sure, I can come up with something. And you go, yeah, I'm going to use all that stuff I took out of chapter 4.
I have a question about the vertical pronoun I. And how much of a character do you make yourself in your own book,
question.
And why?
We'll come back to you for your answer at the end.
I was hoping to avoid that.
I mean, I'm not particularly comfortable writing, self-revelatory things. On the other hand, it was an interesting process because I felt, I am so ignorant about botany. I mean, this book was like a vertical learning curve on every possible dimension, but particularly about botany. The first time I went out with a guy looking for the American chestnut, I was going, is that a chestnut? No, that's an oak. Is that a chestnut? No, that's a sycamore. Is that a chestnut? And it was very embarrassing to me that I knew so little. But then at a certain point, I started to realize, well, actually, that's a value that's useful in the book, and yes. it's useful to treat myself as a character in the book and as a foil for people, and so I started to do that more and to be more comfortable with doing it. It actually paid off, I think, for that.
So you as the everyman ignorant of
as the everyman and sort of thinking
go.
About right. it and and also being able to react. I mean, just some of the people I met were so funny and so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. to step back and do that in this completely distant, dispassionate way, I think would have mm-hmm. been a disservice to them. So
does that mean that your book ends up being a story about your writing the book at some layer?
At some layer, not a whole lot. I mean, I didn't want to do that, and I don't want it to be, it's not about me, and I didn't really want it to be about me, but it was useful to be able to record. I mean, in the beginning, I talk about going to this place in Roaring Springs, Pennsylvania. There was this guy named Barney Barnhart who late in life fell in love with the chestnut and started to collect chestnut, and he would go out into the woods and come back with these pieces of chestnut and, sticks and logs, and then he started, making things out of chestnut and collecting chestnut furniture. And in the end, he had 3 warehouses full of chestnut stuff. So I went out to go see this. He had died, but his widow showed me around it. And it was just, I ended up like that was a place where I reacted to it and tried to see it, wrote about trying to see it through his eyes and having kind of this epiphany about what it was that had drawn him into this, which I think was helpful then to readers, I hope, reading the book and kind of seeing, well, why would somebody care so much about this, dusty piece of wood?
What about you, Michael? Your book is very meditative, so you are there in it all.
I'm only in first person in the introduction. I sort of come out and say, here I am, here's what I'm doing and why, and now I'm going to disappear backstage. Mm-hmm. But I do have, in the tone of voice, I think I'm sort of reacting to everything. That's what I miss in some science writing is you sit around with scientists talking at lunch, and they're going, and this is the most amazing thing, and I learned this, and it made me think of this great old movie. And that's all left out of the scientific papers. So I want to put it all back in. Uh-huh. And so there's always a gee-whiz undertone that you hope is a little more sophisticated than gee-whiz, but I think I descend to that at times. But not much in actual first person, because I'm hiding.
And you?
It's a challenge for me to figure out how much of myself to put in the book, because often I hear from readers that that their favorite parts of the book were the parts that were personal or anecdotal, because I do tend to weave that material into the science writing that I do, and some other people find it distracting. So it's finding a balance, and for me it really comes down to whether the first person serves the material. And it has to be secondary to whatever is the goal of that particular piece of writing. But if it serves the material and it's enlightening for the reader in some way, I don't shy from it.
Do you think that in science writing in particular, there is almost an ethical issue? I mean, as Michael was talking about, in scholarly science writing, even the writing style removes the personal.
Right, it's passive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so is there, by taking on science writing as your genre, are you kind of playing with the rules here a little bit to bring yourself into the picture?
Well, I think as science writers, it's our responsibility to write for people who don't have a background in science. So the first person can be used effectively as to reveal the sort of process of discovery that you went through yourself, as Susan said, to arrive at a point of understanding. And so I think that you don't have to be... As a science writer, you don't have to necessarily, be that objective, passive voice. I think it would actually be to the detriment of the story to take that point of view.
Mm-hmm. One more question, and if there is one, here's one more question.
Well, I guess I'm really responding to your last discussion a little bit, because I guess as I see the science writing being of interest to me, there is this wonderful part about, oh, wow, isn't this fantastic? And I like the personal. However, there are a lot of times when what your reader wants, and hopefully what you're trying to do, is tell me about the science. And if there's anything that I find frustrating these days is journalism in particular. Headline says, new cure for some kind of cancer. And I think, oh, wow, my friend's got that. And I want to find out about the new cure. And I spend 5 paragraphs learning about Peter Jones didn't think he would ever be a victim of it. And I think, okay, hey, get to the meat. How do you learn to draw the line? You know, where do you draw the line, and how do you perhaps also let your reader know what kind of reading they're going to be getting?
And how do you bring, at the other extreme, how do you bring the actual science into the writing?
Yes.
Keep it alive. Mm-hmm. It's a big one.
I think it's really tough in daily journalism and in magazine journalism, partly because science moves slowly. And you're not going to, in fact, the new cure for cancer is not going to be a new cure for cancer. It's going to be maybe the result of one clinical trial in which the scientists are being very cautious about the results and saying, this may be promising, and the journalist is being pushed to try to extract, news you can use from it. I think that it becomes really, really tough to figure out, A, how you put scientific advances into context and make them practical for people, make them useful for people. I like gee whiz stories, and I wish there were more outlets for stories that are just plain interesting. They're not necessarily of immediate practical value. But that, I think that's becoming, ironically, there are more and more outlets for science writing, and yet I feel in some ways it just keeps getting dumber and dumber, and less and less just about science and of interest. And I think there are very few places that you can do that kind of writing, very few magazines, almost no newspapers. The New York Times science section is probably the only one I can think of that runs just plain interesting stories that don't necessarily have an immediate practical hook. I don't know if you guys feel that way.
I don't think we have time to answer. I think we're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I was.
And I can't top what she said.
I want to say thank you.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, that's okay. This has been a great conversation at what Michael calls the borderland between nature and culture. I want to remind you that we do have some time, however, for you to come and meet the authors and have them sign books if you want to do that. Thanks very much.